And I thank Mr. Pischke for the sermon. It's always, he always has something that I never thought of, never noticed. Back before the feast, last fall, I sort of began a series. I gave a sermonette about heresy, and I made the argument that most of the New Testament, my theory at least, most of the New Testament is inspired to combat heresy. That is, most of it was written because of some misunderstanding or outright heresy that needed to be addressed. And the first example I gave was starting from the beginning of the New Testament, when it began to be written, and to be addressed against such wrong ideas, I proposed was Corinthians. So I started with 1 and 2 Corinthians, and we went through some of the indications of the heresy that was causing division there. That was probably the fourth or fifth. Those two letters are probably the fourth and fifth letters of the New Testament, chronologically speaking. And then the next one, chronologically, I'd like to cover as this fight against what I consider the heresy in the New Testament continues. And the next letter, chronologically, would be Galatians. Galatians is obviously written to oppose heresy. I hardly need to prove that. It's pretty obvious. But it's the identification of the heretics there in Galatia which is controversial. And beyond that, what's even more controversial then would be the implications of Paul on Paul's arguments of who those heretics were. Depending on who they were and what they were teaching, that has a great effect on Paul's arguments. So today I might even get into a little speculation about, well, what if the heretics are this? Then what would be the implications on Paul's argument? So number one, prove what doesn't need to be proven, and that was that there were heretics in Galatia. Paul had just finished fighting, that was my position at least in December when I spoke, Paul had just finished fighting the heretics in Corinth by letter with 1 and 2 Corinthians in about the year 57. Then he went to Corinth itself after writing those letters, and he spent 3 months there. And during that time, he apparently receives news of what's going on in the churches of Galatia, because it is apparently during those 3 months in Corinth that he writes the letters to Galatia and then Romans. He hadn't been there for a while. That is, Paul had started his third journey with the churches of Galatia. There are four. Antioch, the Pisidian Antioch, Iconium, Derbe, and Lystra, the four churches in Galatia. He had started there in about 54. Then he had gone to Ephesus and spent two years there. And by the time he gets to Corinth and writes the letter to the Galatians, it's been about 3 years since he's been there. And apparently during that intervening time, trouble has occurred there, and he's gotten word of it. So he writes this letter probably late in 57. And the presence of opponents there is pretty obvious. If you turn to Galatians, just stay there. Galatians 1, verse 6. I marvel that you are so soon to removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel. It's not another, he says, verse 7. It's not a true gospel. But there be some heretics, I'm saying, which trouble you and would pervert the gospel of Christ. But though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel to you, you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. And he says it again. So I say again, if any man preach any other gospel unto you than you have received from Paul, in other words, let him be accursed. Doesn't mean hope you have a bad day. Paul is hopping mad here, I think. To curse them twice is not wishing them a bad day. He wishes that they would be destroyed. This verse is virtually a death wish. He is very upset with the heretics in Galatia. So I don't think there's a slight variation in interpretation or emphasis that the heretics in Galatia are preaching. He preached a gospel in Galatia, and he almost died from it. If you remember, he was stoned and left for dead in Lystra, which is in Galatia, on his first trip. He almost died preaching that gospel there, and now people have come and subverted that gospel, perverted it, and apparently replaced it with something very different, or are trying to replace it with something very different. So this letter is a heated reply that Paul fires back to the churches in Galatia. Now, the heretics are frequently claimed to be Judaizers in all the references, all the literature, or over-Jewish Christians, over-Jewish because they want the Galatians to become more Jewish. But Paul is mincing no words here, that he's very angry at these heretics. I think they're much more dangerous than the Jews of Judaism. Well, in a sense, right? The Jews of Judaism stoned him and left him for dead. That's pretty dangerous. They are dangerous to Christians, but Judaism itself is not dangerous to Christianity. Now, Judaism hardly holds a candle to Christianity as far as a religion. I mean, it's Jewish people trying to observe the Old Testament religion without being able to observe it. They have no temple. They cannot do sacrifice. They have no offering for sin. And, more yet, they have no hope of eternal life. Well, they might have a hope for it. They don't have a basis for that hope. They don't have a Messiah who was raised to life. So I'm saying that Judaism, though it's dangerous to Christians at the time, is not dangerous to Christianity. I don't think it is the dangerous heresy which Paul is cursing, or Paul wishes upon them that they were cursed. Chapter 3. Just a note for a few scriptures that prove that there were indeed heretics in Galatia. I'll just read you a few snippets. 3:1. O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth? Who has bewitched them? It's fairly dangerous. I know they've had some kind of a remarkable effect on the church of Galatia, churches of Galatia, even though Paul was almost killed by the Jews there. The Jews now having that kind of influence over the Galatians, it kind of seems doubtful to me. Anyway, who has bewitched you? 4:17, they zealously affect you, but not well. It's a bad influence. 5:7, who did hinder you that you should not obey the truth? There are who's there teaching heresy. Verse 5:12, I would they were even cut off, which trouble you. I think he's referring to their mutilation. If they can't be killed, at least they could be mutilated, perhaps. He's mad. And at the end of the book, he says in 6:17, from henceforth, let no man trouble me, for I bear them in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. No one disputes, I think, that there were heretics in Galatia. You know, I joke about seeing a heretic under every rock, and I do. That is... Turn to most every book of the New Testament, and there, if you look behind it for the motive of writing the letter, it seems to be correcting some kind of misunderstanding, some heresy. But there's no rock that you need to turn over in Galatia. You know, it's right out front. It's right up on top that it's written to the heretics. The question is, though, what is the heresy? Who are these heretics? What is their heresy? So that's my second point today. What is the nature of the heresy? So I said, I believe personally that there's only one heresy in the New Testament. I listed the general characteristics of it when I spoke last in December, so I'm not going to list that again. You can go back to your notes from December 24th, but I want to go through some of the characteristics that we see here in the book of Galatians about what it's like. But I'll tell you this, that it seems to me that the heresy was born among Jewish intellectuals maybe 100 years before Christianity. Maybe 100 years before. Before Jesus Christ, these Jews, these Jewish intellectuals, had other biblical figures whom they believed to be revelators of a higher God than the God of the Old Testament. They were almost Jewish anti-Jews in the sense that they believed that there was a higher God than the God of the Old Testament. They thought they saw evidence of that in the Old Testament itself, lying below the surface of the literal stories of the Old Testament, and they had their own interpretations of the Old Testament. You can find those interpretations in the library of documents that was dug up at Nag Hammadi in Egypt in 1945. There was a library dug up there which shows that they plainly had figures from the Old Testament as their revelators of their hidden truth, figures such as Seth, the son of Adam, and Melchizedek was another figure regarded as a revelator in the Old Testament. That was B.C. In the first century A.D., as Christianity began to grow and spread, these same people adopted Jesus Christ as the new revelator of their hidden wisdom. They preach Christ, but they preach a very different gospel about him. What do they call themselves? Christians. They call themselves Christians. And their influence grew in the church for hundreds of years. It wasn't until the second and third century that the Catholic writers dubbed them Gnostics because they held a certain gnosis or knowledge, spiritually revealed knowledge that they called their special knowledge. So the Catholic writers dubbed them Gnostics. But in the first century, they were simply called Christians. In the book of Galatians, I believe, Paul simply calls it another gospel in verse 7. It's another gospel. Well, verse 6 it was. Verse 7 says, which is not another. But there be some that trouble you and would pervert the gospel of Christ and replace it with something very different. And I think these are not Jews of Judaism. They're Jews, but they claim to be Christians. Their beliefs about Christ are quite contrary to what Paul has preached, and Paul is angry. He vehemently objects. Verse 8, but though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel to you, and this reference to angels here reveals another aspect of the heresy. It implies that they have contact, or they believe they have contact with angels. They claim some spiritual insight and access to some truth that Paul does not understand and Paul has not preached. Angels often play a role in this heresy in the New Testament. Careful when you see references to angels, that the writer is refuting some misunderstanding about angels. They believe that there was an angel hierarchy through which the quote-unquote spiritual person receives knowledge of the true God. Another characteristic of the heresy is revealed in verse 15 through 17. When it pleased God who separated me from my mother's womb and gave me and called me by his grace to reveal his son in me, that is when I was converted, that I might preach him among the heathen, then what? Immediately I conferred not with flesh and blood, neither went I up to Jerusalem to them which were apostles before me. He spends the first couple chapters of this book refuting the idea that he only got his gospel from men, and those men were in Jerusalem. In other words, that he was nothing more than the mouthpiece of the men of Jerusalem. Why does he have to do this? It's because his opponents in Galatia are claiming that that's all he is. They, however, are spiritual. They are in direct contact with the true God. Through the revelator Jesus Christ, But Paul doesn't know this. Paul is not spiritual. Paul only knows what he was told to say by the apostles of Jerusalem. That's what they're arguing. In chapter 2, another characteristic of the heresy there. Chapter 2 and verse 9. He's speaking of the conference in Jerusalem, I think, when he says, when James, Peter, and John, who seem to be pillars, perceived the grace which was given unto me, they gave to me and Barnabas, who was along at the conference, the right hands of fellowship, that we should go to the heathen and they to the circumcision. So he brings up the conference in Jerusalem here against these heretics in Galatia. But what is significant is what he does not say about the conference. He's referring to the conference where they decided that circumcision is not necessary. This was 8 years ago. Now, we're talking Galatians 57, the conference in 49. 8 years ago, all the elders and apostles of Jerusalem decided circumcision was not necessary. He brings up this conference here that he was in Jerusalem at that time and recognized as a co-equal with the other apostles. Now there are Jews, somebody in Galatia, who's teaching that circumcision is required. Why does he not say, well, look, James, Peter, all the apostles said you're wrong. All you Jewish Christians should understand that we don't have to be circumcised, or we don't have to circumcise the Gentiles. He does not bring it up. He does not bring it up because this is evidence that it holds no credence to the heretics in Galatia. They do not care about the opinion of the apostles. They do not respect the apostles of Jerusalem. The apostles of Jerusalem are just carnal men. These apostles in Galatia are spiritual and have a direct contact to the true God. It's just another evidence that the heretics in Galatia are not Judaizers. He goes on with this argument in chapter 2, verse 11, the story of Peter. When Peter was come to Antioch, Paul, withstood him to the face because he was to be blamed, for before that certain came from James, he did eat with the Gentiles. But when they were come from James, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. Peter made a mistake. Obviously he made a mistake. But the point is not, I don't think, Peter's mistake in trying to separate Jews and Gentiles. The story is continuing the argument that Paul is not the lackey of the mere men of Jerusalem. He has stood up to Peter. He is co-equal with Peter. He is not the lackey of Peter. He is not an inferior apostle, only the apostle of men, as the heretics claim that he is. Again, these are not Jewish Christians from Jerusalem, because they would not argue such things. Chapter 3, verse 1. O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you, that you should not obey the truth, before whose eyes, your eyes, Jesus Christ has been evidently set forth by me, Paul, crucified among you. Who has bewitched you from that truth, that Jesus Christ was crucified? And this was central, of course, to Paul's gospel that he preached in Galatia. Jesus Christ died as a sacrifice. Jesus Christ died as a sacrifice. They denied it. They denied it. Now, his death had done away with the Old Testament religion, the Old Testament sacrificial religion, the ceremonial religion. He had totally replaced it. This the heretics denied. They denied that Jesus Christ was killed and resurrected. He could not have been killed. He was a spirit. It was probably fairly easy to convince the Galatians of this because, you know, the Galatians didn't have the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, especially John. Of course, none of them had been written yet. All they had was the Old Testament and what Paul had told them, and now there were people coming to Galatia twisting it. But it's an evidence, I think, that that they denied the crucifixion of Christ. They denied him as a sacrifice. Verse 2. This only would I learn of you, receive you the Spirit by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith. Now this is something quite mysterious in Paul's writings here. He mysteriously calls something works of law. This is often taken to mean obedience to the Old Testament, as in the idea that if you obey the law, you can earn salvation. But that's an assumption that that's what he means. That ain't necessarily so. It's an assumption. This mysterious expression, works of the law, is used only in the Bible by Paul. You know, only by Paul, and only in the letters to the Galatians 6 times, and the Romans 1 time. And so you have to interpret what he means by this in context. Now there's one clue outside of the Bible as to what this could mean, and it's a reference to works of law in a document that was dug up in Qumran, in the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1946. There was a document there called the MMT. It's written in Hebrew. But in the letter, a member of a Jewish sect writes to another sect, quote, "We have written to you some of the works of the Torah which we think are good for you and for your people." And if you translate works of the Torah to Greek, it's the same thing as Paul's written here, nomos, ergon nomos, works of the law. And in this letter, this Hebrew letter, found at Qumran, works of the law are described. There are all kinds of priestly rituals, rituals of purification, primarily pertaining to the priesthood. I'm not saying that these were the heretics. You know, the heretics didn't write the document at Qumran. But I'm just saying that the expression works of the law was written in Qumran about the same time as Paul is writing the same phrase to the Galatians in the first century. So it's not unknown outside of Paul that this could be rituals of the law, priestly rituals. The heresy, on the other hand, denies Jesus Christ as a sacrifice. It finds its spirituality through adaptations of Old Testament rituals, strangely enough. I mean, you combine the two, they seem contradictory. Spirituality above the Old Testament and rituals from the Old Testament, but they did it. They had adaptations of rituals from the Old Testament. Paul is arguing against all such ritualism, which they used as a gateway or initiation to their spirituality. Chapter 4, some other indications of what the heresy was about. 4:9. But now, after that you have known God, or rather are known of God, how turn you again to the weak and beggarly elements whereunto you desire again to be in bondage? You observe days and months and times and years. Now, I said that they may be adapting rituals of the Old Testament, and there are no rituals in the Old Testament which are this list. Days, months, and times and years are not biblical. They're not there in the Bible. The heretics have borrowed from ignorant astrological ideas of the Greeks. These ideas, Greek mysteries and other mystery religions. I say ignorant because the Greeks were ignorant of astronomy. They believed in astrology, but not astronomy. I mean, they were ignorant of astronomy. They held the earth-centric notion. That's never taught in the Bible, of course, but the Greeks believed that the planets and the stars revolved around the earth. Have you ever read, for example, Plato's Timaeus? I call it, Plato explains it all. because he's got an explanation for how everything works in that. But it's nonsense. It's all scientific nonsense. It's amazing that Plato has the reputation that he has. But anyway, they were scientifically ignorant. And the heretics in Galatia have apparently adopted some of those ideas. They certainly adopted the idea of the immortal soul, and that was largely popularized by Plato. They have also then adopted Hellenistic ideas. These are Hellenistic Jews who have adopted Greek ideas, and amongst them they have been influenced by Greek superstitions such as astrology. They apparently held the belief that there was a heavenly hierarchy of angels through these layers of planets and stars above us. And therefore there were good times and bad times to do things. Like you read your astrology chart for the day. There are good days and months and times and years. And that's what they were observing in Galatia, based upon superstitious, ignorant astrology. Chapter 5, verse 2. Behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you be circumcised, Christ shall profit you nothing. For I testify again to every man that is circumcised that he is a debtor to do the whole law. Well, circumcision is certainly a big issue in this letter, and it's naturally assumed that therefore the heresy must be Judaism. Who else would teach circumcision? But look, that this verse 3 is a strange thing to say to a Jew. If you're circumcised, you're a debtor to do the whole law. Well, of course you are. I mean, that's why you become circumcised as a Jew, to take on the covenant. But the heretics, in fact, and I think this is evidence, are not practicing Judaism. They have no intention of keeping the law. They find freedom from the law in their spiritual knowledge. It makes them libertine. It makes them immoral. Once the heretics, in other words, have achieved their spiritual state, they are free from the constraints of the flesh. Their behavior, in fact, is deplorable. Paul has to tell them to remember then, if you're circumcised, you're supposed to keep the law. But they had no intent of doing that. Verse 5:13. Brethren, you have been called into liberty. Only use not liberty for an occasion to the flesh, but serve one another. The heretics, in other words, they wanted to use their liberty from the flesh to do whatever they wanted. That was from sexual license, which they practiced, to participation in pagan religions such as eating meat sacrificed to idols, which they taught. Another characteristics in verse 5:15. If you bite and devour one another, you Christians in Galatia, take heed that you be not consumed of one another. Now, wherever this heresy appears in the New Testament, it causes envy and jealousy in the congregation. That is, the Christians who have this supposed wisdom, this enlightenment, this knowledge, consider themselves superior to the other Christians, and it causes jealousy and contention. And then in chapter 5, he makes an interesting comparison between two spirits. And I think this is a contrast between spirits, because spirituality is the issue here. What is true spirituality? Verse 19, now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these, adultery, fornication, and so on, a whole list of bad things. But in contrast, verse 22, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, and peace, and so on, a lot of good things. And he concludes rather tellingly, I think, with the statement in verse 23, against such there is no law. Now, this is a contrast between the behavior of the heretics in Galatia and the behavior of those who have the true Spirit of God. It's an issue about spirituality. Who has the true Spirit of God? Paul is saying that the behavior of the heretics is immoral, but the fruit of the true Spirit of God is all good. So, in contrast, the fruit of their spirit is illegal. It's against the law. But the fruit of God's Spirit, against such there is no law. It's a contrast. And in chapter 6, something more about the indication of circumcision. 6:12, as many as desire to make a fair show in the flesh, they constrain you to be circumcised. Again, it seems like they must be Jews. Only lest they should suffer persecution for the cross of Christ. For neither they themselves who are circumcised keep the law. Once again, these are not Judaizers. These are not Orthodox Jews. They have no intention of keeping the law. For neither they themselves who are circumcised, these people keep the law. They do not keep it. They only adopt some of the form of its rituals. So those are the characteristics I see of the heresy in Galatia. The third part here, number three, is then what are the implications if those are the heretics in Galatia? What are the implications of that on the arguments that Paul is making here? And this is the speculative part. But I toss it out to you as food for thought. The different interpretation you can get from some of Paul's statements if you identify the heretics the way I just have. That is, are they Orthodox Jews, or are they ritual-practicing spiritualists? Which one? For example, in chapter 5, when Paul says, Christ has become no effect to you, whosoever of you are justified by the law, you are fallen from grace. That's in chapter 5. How should we interpret that? Justified by the law, you're fallen from grace. Now, if his opponents were Jewish Christians who want the Galatians to be more careful in observing the laws better, then you'd have to say that there's a contrast here between obedience and grace. Justified by the law, you're fallen from grace. However, if his opponents are ritualistic, then you have a contrast between justification by ritual. That is, reaching God, the true God, by ritual versus justification by Christ's sacrifice, which is the grace of God. Now, Paul seemingly uses the word law, and not just seemingly, he does use the word law ambiguously in this letter, does he not? That means different things by the word law in different contexts. I think probably if we had lived in Galatia in 57 AD, we would have known exactly what he meant, because we were there standing there listening to the heretics, and we knew what they were preaching, and he's dropping a bombshell on them, and we know what he means by works of the law and so forth. To them it was perfectly clear. That's why they saved the letter in the canon of the New Testament. It wasn't there to cause problems. It was there to be perfectly clear that this heresy that they were combating and combated for hundreds of years was wrong. Another example, when in chapter 5, when Paul says something like, if you be led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. What does that mean? You're not under the law. Seems ambiguous to us. If his opponents are Judaizers, then perhaps he meant the penalty of the law. You're not under the penalty of the law. We know it cannot mean that you don't have to obey the law. That's obvious, right? Everybody in this room knows that. We know from the whole Bible that's not true. Any converted reader knows that you have to obey God. God's laws are eternal, as Mr. Pischke was just pointing out. But if his opponents are not Judaizers, if his opponents are spiritualists who use rituals derived from the Old Testament, and they themselves have no intention of keeping God's law, then Paul's argument is quite different. Then it's, if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the ritual law. And that's quite possible interpretation, if they are spiritual ritualists. If he's arguing against Judaism, he could not, obviously, and I admit, if he was arguing against Judaism, he could not be saying that they are advocating ritual laws. Judaism cannot advocate rituals outside of the tabernacle and the temple. They have no tabernacle and temple in Galatia. They cannot be advocating ritualism if, indeed, the opponents are Judaism or Judaizers. But if he is arguing against men who advocate rituals, spiritual ritualists, circumcision being the prime example of the ritual that they're advocating, then the ritual law can be the meaning, and they can be advocating rituals outside of Jerusalem. It all hinges on who the heretics are. Who are they? Let us assume for a moment that they are spiritual ritualists. Just bear with me. I'm not probably convincing you, because you got to read the whole letter for yourself and review this on your own time. But just suppose, for example, for a moment here, that they are spiritualists, ritualist spiritualists, teaching what Paul would later call Jewish fables. And when he writes to Titus, he calls them Jewish fables. But whose actual behavior was very bad. Assuming that is true, and you be the judge, let me do some reinterpretations of a couple of Paul's arguments here. This is the speculative part. Let's turn back to chapter 2. One of the key verses in Galatians 2:16. Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ, even we have believed in Jesus Christ that we might be justified by the faith of Christ, not by the works of the law, for by the works of the law shall no flesh be saved. By the way, there's three times. Of his seven times that this phrase appears in the Bible, there's three of them in one verse, works of the law. By the way, it could be just read works of law. There's no definite article in there. Works of law, but he is obviously referring to something from the Old Testament law. So you could say the law from the Torah, works of the law, or it literally is just works of law. But here is a contrast between the faith Christ, and that's all it literally says, justified by works of the law, but by the faith Christ, or the faith Jesus Christ. There's no definite article there. And so the debate has raged for centuries as to whether this should be translated faith of Christ or faith in Christ. You know, if you translated faith of Christ, then it's doing what Christ did. If you translated faith in Christ, then you could say, well, we just have faith in Christ's sacrifice. He's done everything for us. And then there's the ambiguity of the word faith. I've covered that before. Now, the Greek word that's translated faith here is actually much bigger than the word faith, which is an English word. The word in Greek encompasses both faith and faithfulness. That is, it encompasses both the ideas of belief and obedience. Which one he means depends upon the context. So does the nature then of the heretics, the nature of the heresy, does it shed any light on what Paul is arguing here? If the heretics have no intention of obeying God, and I think they don't, works of law do not mean the substance of the law. Instead, they mean ritual, ceremony, of which circumcision is the prime example. And Paul is arguing a matter of form versus substance. They are advocating form, which is ritual. He is advocating substance, which is the law. Paul is arguing that to be among the just, you must practice the faithfulness of Christ. That is what Christ believed and practiced. That is his total dedication, his surrender to every word of God, as opposed to works of law, which can mean ritual, if the heretics are spiritual ritualists. So instead of having a contrast here in this key verse to so many Protestant Christians, at least, a contrast between obedience and faith, what we actually may have here is a contrast between ritual and substance. In other words, a man is not justified by rituals of the law, but by the faithfulness as Christ, or faithfulness like Christ. So it hinges on who the heretics are. It's very important to identify who the heretics are, I think. Let's go on to another example. Chapter 3. Or another alternate interpretation. 3:10 through 13, really. But first 10 first. 3:10. For as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone that continues not in all things that are written in the book of the law to do them. He's probably referring to Deuteronomy 27, where there's a long list of curses for all kinds of major sins. They're not ritual things, but real substance of the law violations. And it could be that Paul is contrasting rituals, like circumcision here, versus the whole substance of the law. In other words, as many as observe the form of the law are under God's curse. They're still under God's curse because they do not keep the major tenets of the law. They do not keep the substance of the law. Verse 11. But that no man is justified by the law in the sight of God, it is evident, for the just shall live by faith. This also, again, may be contrasting ritual and ceremony versus substance. He's saying, but instead they are just who obey the substance of the law. And he's quoting here from Habakkuk 2:4, where in the prophet is saying the Chaldeans are coming. The Chaldeans are coming to punish the nation of Judah. The wicked are going to be punished, but Habakkuk says the just are going to survive. The just are going to live and not die. That is clearly what the prophet meant in the book of Habakkuk. Paul quotes it here about living and not dying. Paul is saying no man is called just because he does ritual, works of law, but because he is faithful to the covenant with God. The just will live because of his faithfulness. If the law is ritual and not substance. Verse 12. And the law is not of faith, but the man that does them shall live in them. What does that mean? Some people have interpreted that, well, if you're going to live in the law, you have to keep it perfectly. I don't think that's his idea at all. But in other words, what Paul is saying, the ritual law is not about obedience. The ritual doesn't earn you what obedience earns you. He cites Leviticus 18:5, where it says, you shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man do, he shall live in them. I am the Lord. And this is the contrast. It is not works of law, in other words, which makes a person just, but the man who actually obeys the law will live, and this agrees with what Habakkuk said. The just will live because of his faithfulness. Not because of his works of law. If works of law means ritual, and it can mean ritual if the heretics are spiritual ritualists. Verse 13, Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is everyone that hangs on a tree. What Christ's sacrifice removed was what? It removed the ritual law. He totally replaced the ritual law of the Old Testament. Break the moral law, Paul is saying, and you are cursed, until you're forgiven at least, and then Christ forgives you because he becomes the curse for you. He is sacrificed. Now, you're not going to find these alternative explanations in many translations, in any major translation or any of the major commentaries. And I think almost no one considers that works of law were rituals, because almost no one identifies Paul's opponents as ritual or spiritual ritualists. The idea is entrenched, that the heretics are over Jewish Christians who want us to become Jews. And if it's Judaism, then this leaves no room for works of law to be ritualistic. They couldn't practice rituals away from Jerusalem. But I'm saying the heretics are not Orthodox Jews. They are Jews, but they are preachers of an alternate Christianity that is far, far from Judaism. That's why it's important, I think, to identify who the heretics in Galatia are. Here's another example, 3:18. For if the inheritance be of the law, it is no more of promise, but God gave it to Abraham by promise. What's his point here? I think his point is that circumcision is a ritual. It is a ritual seal of the promise that was given to Abraham. But ritualism is not the start of righteousness. Ritualism is not righteousness. It's just as John wrote in 1 John, where he's fighting the same heresy later on in the first century, near the end of the first century. John writes, he that does righteousness is righteous. Simple. Who is righteous? He who does righteousness is righteous. Paul is arguing the same thing. Paul's point is that Abraham was given the promise not because he was circumcised, but because he was faithful. He obeyed God. And verse 19. I'll take just one more. Galatians 3:19. Wherefore then serves the law? It was added because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. Here's another example of Paul's ambiguous use of the word law. I mean, you can't tell for sure what he means by law here. Because we know that Abraham obeyed God's law way before, 400 years before Sinai. I mean, Genesis 26:5. Abraham obeyed God's laws. Then the Old Covenant, the whole Old Covenant was established 430 years after, and I think Paul is not just addressing ritual law, and I would grant that. He's not addressing just ritual law in verse 19 that was added, but it only makes sense that he's referring to the tabernacle rituals because it is the tabernacle rituals which forgave sin. It was added because of transgressions. You sinned, you did a sacrifice, you were forgiven. It served for that purpose until Christ came and did away with it and replaced it for all time. This is the simple answer. I think it's the simple answer. And if you'd been in Galatia in 57 AD, it would have, I think, been obvious what the simple answer is. But we weren't there, so we don't know exactly who they were and what they were teaching. Theologians have worked around the obvious conclusion for centuries because they could not believe that rituals were being advocated in Galatia. Jews would never advocate rituals, and surely these are Jews. Now, there are many other things that could be said, and maybe I've raised more questions than answers to you, but you get the point. Paul is arguing what the commentaries have long believed is the issue, then his words mean one thing. But if these are spiritual ritualists, then they mean something quite different. It all hinges on who the opponent is. So, three points were, again, that the Galatians were obviously influenced by a heresy. Paul's writing against a heresy. The nature of the heresy, I don't know if I convinced you what the nature of the heresy was, but it could as easily have been spiritual ritualists as it was Judaizers, and I think the weight of evidence is strongly in the form of the former, not the latter. And then if you buy that the nature of the heresy was, as I've tried to paint it, there obviously are implications on the interpretation of Paul's epistles. This heresy, then, that was, whatever it was, that was taught in Galatia, did not end in Galatia. In subsequent years, it spread to all of the province of Asia. We're going to see it combated from prison in Paul's prison epistles. We're going to see it combated by the general epistles of Peter and Jude And then later in the first century, it is combated by the writings of John. But, taking them sequentially here, on the heels of Galatians, the next letter that Paul writes is Romans. He writes it about the same time from Corinth. And Romans is a little harder than Galatians because Romans, we don't know who the heretics were, whether there were heretics in Rome, and yet he makes some of the same arguments to the Romans. So, I'll just warn you, in coming months, that's where I'll probably go.